Hi, everybody. Welcome again to a reading by Marianne Baruch. We had a beautiful reading last night. I thought it was a very moving reading, so if you were there, you probably, I hope, felt that too. Today is a bonus reading from her memoir, and I don't have a big introduction for it because I haven't read it yet, although I just bought it. But I do think that poets are often the best prose writers, just saying. And so I look forward to today's reading. And now, welcome, Marianne. Thank you.
Oh, okay, so it's really fun to read from this memoir. And I want to thank Marianne for inviting me here, and also to letting me read from this. This is sort of something we cooked up at the last minute. I guess I'll just jump in. I'm going to just jump around. This book, this little wee book, is it's really this the story, the memory that I have of hitchhiking to California when I was 20. It was 1971, and that was not an unusual thing to do. Lots of people were doing that, hitchhiking all over the country. Maybe some people in this room even. So I went on spring break. I went with someone I didn't know, really. She had a woman who was already, she was a year older than I was, and she was already a widow, which seemed very exotic to me, and sad, of course. She was friends of a friend, and her husband had died coming back from California. He was in a car wreck in the Rockies. Okay, so that's all I knew about her, really. And I talked, someone else in going with us, this guy who was the ex-boyfriend, had recently dumped of a high school friend of mine who had been a CO in the, in Vietnam. A CO in Vietnam, meaning he was a medic there. His draft board allowed him to be a CO, but then they sent him off anyway as a medic. And this happens sometimes, right? It's kind of rare, but it did happen. So he was just out. He had served his time, and he was going back to California, or going to California where his parents had moved, and he wanted to go with us. So he went out there with us. So his name is Woody. The woman who was a year older than I was, is Frances, and I don't think you need to know much more. I thought it was going to be just kind of a lark, like, ooh, let's go to California, the promised land at that period. But it turned out to be something quite different. So it turned out there was a mission. And that was that I learned halfway there was that Francis wanted to find out what had happened to Ned in California before he had was coming back to her in Illinois. So that's basically what happened. And so I got drawn into it, too. So I'm going to read several sections. Also, I'm just going to read some. I was raised Catholic. We were just talking about this in the huddle in the corner. So I have all these crazy Catholic school stories. So I got to sort of put them in here. So I'm going to read at least one of those. So I'm going to jump around and read you bits. So this first section, we're in the middle of Nebraska on the hitchhiking trip out. We've been waiting a long, long time. And finally this hippie van shows up, or we thought was a hippie van. It was one knockout van, that's sure, your classic case or trying to be. Spray-painted in day-glow colors, bad art chrome rip-offs, cartoon guys angled so far back angled as far back as they could and still be upright, walking all over the side and up onto the roof in those big shoes, and scattered about old familiars even then, cast in tall capital letters, keep on truckin', and all you need is love, that sort of thing. Give peace a chance, and flower power, and tune in, drop out. Woody eased into a faint whistle. Shit, you've got to be kidding. Hey, this is the Midwest, Francis said. We have to work overtime. We're just catching up to the coast. Besides, they look young, they're babies. Bingo, I guess, Woody said. Maybe we were hallucinating. No, because I heard the van shifting down, coughing, yanked up to stop, And yes, the door opened out, not a slider, that came later. This was the old, regular sort of VW door. You guys, the driver shouted, you headed somewhere? A quick decision, tell all or part. West, Francis yelled, going for general. Then, Denver, or she stopped here, weighing the situation. California, she said at last. All right, Cali, Fornaye, far out, far fucking out, cried another guy in pure jubilance, the one in the tie-dyed everything, t-shirt, jacket, headband, a whirl in blues and reds, what we could see from the road anyway. The driver turned to him. Slap me five, bro, then faced us again. Yo, California, get your asses in here. We got everything you want in this here friggin' remarkable van. Now, where in California, the tie-dye guy said, riding the shotgun to us once, Woody and I wedged ourselves in the second seat, and Francis slipped further back behind us. He had turned around, and I could see he was a bit younger than we were, but not by much. He put on his wire rims so he could check us out. Whoa, you in the army, man? He asked Woody, who had taken off his stocking cap. It's that hair. It gave him away. Yep, well, no, just out, in fact. That's it for me and Uncle Sam. Forever and ever. I'm out of there. He was a medic, I jumped in. He's really a CO. A CO? The driver yelled out over the racket of the van. Right on! But I thought that meant you didn't have to do nothing except maybe work in a nursing home or teach in the ghetto or something stateside. Not according to my draft board, Woody shouted back. I thought so too. No such luck. Bummer, man. I mean, I hear you, Tie-Dye said. And yeah, I heard that, you know, about how every draft board is different. Then he looked intrigued. Hey, how was it over there, man? Lots of good dope, right? Pow, 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 pow. He spun out his forefinger, firing his hand in a wide half circle. I bet you saw plenty of blood and guts, too. Woody turned away, staring out the window. I could see he really didn't want this conversation to go on. But I could also see these guys would be fine with that. They weren't going to call him a baby killer or ask him about our policy with Red China or what he thought the ethics were, are using Agent Orange. These guys weren't brainiacs by a long shot. They just wanted to fill the air with noise and beyond that have a good time. But Woody shut down. Well, hey, let's celebrate you're getting your CO ass out of there, man, shouted the driver in a magnanimous sort of way. Let's break out the tow truck reefer. He means, said Tie-Dye, the really good stuff, like call the tow truck, I am wrecked. The driver turned on the music, Crosby, Stills, and Nash blaring, and then the strobe light they had somehow wired up to the overhead fixture. Cool, huh? Got that on sale at the only head shop they got in the dumb shit place we come from. By the way, he shouted back, you guys been to Woodstock? Nope, not me, I said. Not these two either. Actually, I was guessing that, but neither Francis nor Woody stirred up to contradict me. Too bad, he said. Because we're collecting Woodstock stories, so we can say we did that stuff, you know? Like we'd been there. Got all naked and muddy, saw Janice scream her guts out, and Jimmy do a fucking absolute star-spangled banner. Before either of them croaked last fall, my friend here means, said Tie-Dye, turning around to us. Hey, you guys sneaky set fire to his guitar at Woodstock, too? Hendrix, I mean. That would have been ultra outstanding. I bet he did. And he played with his teeth sometimes. I heard that before, too. How many guitars do you think he fried like that? Woo-wee, the driver sang out. Wish we could have went. Francis shifted back into the beanbag chair they'd set up as a third seat behind Woody and me. Those guys at it for a while, remembering in great detail a long list of outrageous things they never witnessed. I closed my eyes, leaned against the window, and wondered if Francis was thinking about Ned, or how long this ride would be, or maybe nothing at all, and Tie-Dye started rolling joints. That's pretty much what it was like when you got picked up by anyone under 30. They brought out the weed and turned up the music. They passed around what food they had. They drove all night, taking turns at the wheel, while you slept as best you could, propped up against your backpack. That van, though, it seemed a particular miracle no cops stopped us. You'd think that homemade R-Crumb paint job would be a major tip-off to the world-o-reefer inside. It was practically a theme park in there. But nothing ever happened. No interest. It's like we drove on in a bubble. Tie-Dye and his friend were from Lincoln, the pinnacle, they said, the polis of Nebraska. Fucking polis, were their exact words. Of the great state of Nebraska. They loved to say that over and over. That great in there really cracked them up. That's the only reason they'd watch political conventions on TV, they said. All those stiffs with microphones prefacing their vote count with the great state of whatever, Maine or Texas or Florida or Illinois, no matter. Mr. Chairman, the great state of Rhode Island proudly cast its pathetic, infinitesimally small, and perfectly worthless number of votes for that total loser, Harvey W. Poindexter III. They'd laugh like maniacs, taking turns in toning that, stoned or not. What primo bullshit, Tie-Dye liked to say. Then it was primo everything for a while. The primo joint he had just rolled. The primo map of the western states on the dashboard. The primo box of Cheerios crushed under the seat. Those guys were definitely not political. They lived in the upper stratosphere where they'd somehow gotten out of the draft. We couldn't figure out how, since they didn't appear to be in school with the deferment coming that way. But they were headed to Sacramento, where Tie-Dye had a cousin. They figured they'd like the girls there, or the girls would like them better than in Lincoln. That got them, too, laughing until they nearly choked. Oh, yeah, they'd say to each other. Oh, yeah, the girls would like us way better. I really didn't want to know what that meant. Maybe their IQs are too low, even for the Army, Francis said to us at a rest stop while they were in the can. The other thing about getting picked up by people our age was the stone toys they'd pass out. That cracked us up. After a few rounds passing the joint, sure enough, those toys would appear, treasures to be shared, pointless, beautiful toys like thick blue waves trapped in a see-through plastic box. You'd sit there and hold it in both hands, lifting one side a little, then the other, and the waves would do their thing and make an ocean. It definitely helped to be stoned. Those Lincoln boys had an array of such items. The driver's first promise was true. This was one friggin' remarkable van. And that old VW cut through the mountains, all right. Mountains. Do you believe it? That all this piled-up rock could look this way? Tie-Dye said in a hushed tone, way past Cheyenne, almost to Laramie. A moment of genuine poetry. So we stopped the van, staring out and up. Hey, check out that sign. Scenic Overlook, Tie-Dye would say, as we passed through what was left of Wyoming into Utah and Nevada. He'd open his arms wide. That's a goddamn command, he'd tell us repeatedly. It's required, man. It's the law. Hey, they'll arrest us right here, right now, this second, unless we sit back on our thumbs for a while to just gaze. So, they're my Lincoln boys. They were pretty wonderful. Okay. So I said I was raised Catholic, and part of that, when you're a kid in Catholic schools, they take you over to go to confession, you know, before First Fridays. And every month, I don't know, did anybody have this experience? No. So, you know, when you're a little kid and you're going to confession, you know, what do you confess, you know? I mean, but it's all about the examination of conscience, you know, like from the time you're seven. It's really, you know, ultra self-consciousness from the beginning. Anyway, so this is a little piece about that. This is going off, we were in our travels on this trip. We went down to Big Sur, and we went to the Esalen Institute, and we were expected to take off our clothes and jump into the baths, which, of course, shocked us. Like, you know, fortunately, we got out of it. But anyway, so I'm thinking about this somewhat. Okay. That business of the body, unveiling it with such low-key ceremony, or none at all, to a cast of, if not thousands, at least more than one, what to think about that when one is 20? When I was 20, I guess, I mean. Or any age, if the truth be told. My experience of this sort of thing was, as a friend might of mine like to say, of any near-miss chances, slim and none. The slimmest, in fact, was closer to none in grade school, late spring, the very end of third grade for me, behind our house, in the back corner of our yard. One of the many kids from across the street, Ricky Vaccarello, probably, a highly advanced fourth grader, suggested we all retire there after supper to show what we had. He meant we were to pull down our pants and note the varied view. But it turned out so quickly managed that I barely recall anything, except naturally that we had done that. The circle of us squeezed in behind the bushes between two rusted trash cans. The scene floated now in my blurry past, a mortal sin for sure. My brother was older. "You dumbbell," he said. "That's a venial sin. It hardly counts." Besides, he pointed out, we hadn't seen that much anyway. Not really. In any case, he didn't need to bring it up the following Thursday morning when we'd be hauled out of class at St. Eugene's and trotted over to the church to queue up at the confessional booths to ready ourselves for Mass and Communion the following day, the first Friday in June, when a clean slate would be required. My problem was more about language than guilt. The many times I'd confessed my backtalk to parents, meanness to my brother, my lying about whatever small thing, pouting about this or that, hadn't prepared me for, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I pulled down my pants in front of others behind the garbage cans in my own backyard." Such a description had no ring to it, no official sounding, bland enough summary aura. I needed a tidy box, a category. It wasn't yet anything one could drop simply onto a list of small undoings and move blithely on. That mystery about language is the oldest and most puzzling I know of. How it makes the lived thing real or not real or only partly, be it written or spoken in that long, seemingly easy passage from one human to another. Sitting in the pew waiting my turn via the semi-dire sign from Sister Mary Michael the Archangel, her forefinger pointing directly and then crooked back to usher me toward the confessional, I flushed hot, then cold. How to find words for this terrible sin? Impure action, the standard follow-up to impure thought, didn't seem to cover it. That sounded way worse than it actually was. Mainly we giggled, half of us closing our eyes anyway. How I happened abruptly on nudist colony is unclear to me, even now. Maybe I'd seen some reference in Life magazine or on TV, but I'd heard that people took walks, read the paper on park benches, ate at picnic tables, played tennis, small events of a life passed through entirely naked in such a place. Nothing earth-shattering about it. It would be a big deal to us, of course, kids out back among those galvanized cans, and not exactly what we were up to. Still, the phrase felt close enough. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned," I began the usual way, pouring out my clutch of failures in what seemed a credible number for each transgression. The lies, the turns of disobedience or impatience or rage. And as if it happened at least every other week, out came the, "And I went to a nudist colony." That phrase seemed hyphenated, practically one word, the way I rushed through it, then nearly gulped it back. Nothing was said for at least 30 seconds. The old priest must have been weary of hearing about back talk and stealing dimes from the morning's gaggle of young penitents. "A nudist colony," he said, slow enough, and with interest. He had decidedly come to. "Yes, Father." "I see," he said. "And were your parents there?" I considered this as shrewdly as any Jesuit might. Those gears supposedly inside one's head clicking away, spinning on and by their way of their lovely juice. I could feel them doing that, coming up with an answer. What is meant by the word there, I reasoned. How big is there? I mean, my parents were in the house, just a few yards away, probably watching Gunsmoke on TV. If there is defined as yard and house, wouldn't that be the ticket? Couldn't I say yes? "Yes," I said. "They were there." "I see," said Father McGuire. "I see," he repeated at least once more. I could hear the kids queued up outside, their rustle and fidgeting. They were wondering what was taking so long. "You realize this is a very serious matter," he finally said. "Now, listen to me carefully. No matter what, no matter who insists, you are not to go there anymore. Do you understand that, my child?" "Yes, Father." "All right, then, for your penance, say 3 Our Fathers, 6 Hail Marys, for purity, and 5 Glory Bees, that the Holy Ghost guide you. Go in peace, my child." I tore out of the confessional back to the pew, not feeling all that newly hatched clean the way the nuns claimed I would. Their pitch seemed right off television, like an ad for a new detergent. or for hand soap, a gleaming pink, sparking random bolts of lightning as it sat innocently on the bathroom ledge. I never spoke of our backyard short-order nudist colony to my mother, either. That is, until she was nearly 80. I thought she'd think the story funny by then, long out of the old neighborhood, her living in Florida for years. Oh, no, God, you didn't tell him that, she stuttered. No wonder Father McGuire always looked at me crosswise. Mortified, she was shaking her head. Truth is overrated. Big mistake, telling her even then. Anyway, okay. Okay, so one of the places we stopped in California was, as I said, Big Sur, and we stayed with a guy named Emil White, who was an artist. He had been best friend to Henry Miller, who lived on Big Sur, and was sort of his helper and aider and abettor and gopher and everything. And he called himself the unofficial mayor of Big Sur, and he's the one that took us down to the Esalen Institute, which was just down the road, Highway 1. And his house now, he's dead now, of course, but his house is now the Henry Miller Museum on Big Sur. You can actually visit it. Anyway, it turned out that Ned had stayed there, so we went there. We were there a couple of nights, so this is later in the book. And I was there, of course. Woody, we left in Sacramento, and he went north to Portland, Oregon, and Francis and I continued, so it's just the two of us. There remained the more earthbound, semi-dicey matter of where we would sleep. I moved in and out of that thought all day and even brought it up to Francis in a private off moment at Esalen when Emil had edged away from us. He was standing at one with, yes, yet another beautiful blonde in very little but a beaded vest. She appeared to be snuggling back. I should say that Emil is about 70 here. Okay. He's an old Austrian. I don't think you'll hit on me, Francis said, as we tried to watch without appearing to. Only she didn't say hit on. That phrase came into parlance later, I think. And I can't recall when putting the moves or the make on anyone made its appearance in the lexicon of the young. She probably said he wouldn't be coming on to her at this time around. Frances figured she was safe, out of the question, given Ned. She was literally beyond that, thanks to tragedy. It's too close, you know, she told me. I don't think Emil will try anything. That was another way to put it. Would he try something? It was one of those vague phrases my mother used when my brother and I were teenagers. There were others, often involving something she considered off-color, another puzzling phrase. Ma, what color is that? She'd point out a remark we'd heard and were starting to repeat as suggestive. That meant no doubt about it, case closed, not allowed. That was our cue to ask with feigned innocence, suggestive of what, Ma, what? And she'd shake her head like, forget it, she knew our smart aleck tricks. She was on to us. She wasn't about to be drawn into a conversation like that. I think of it now as an exercise in remote sensing, talking around the point, suggestive, at the heart of an introduction to metaphor, its wiring near electric and quick, the basis of all poetry, according to Aristotle. But one could be more direct. In high school English class, my freshman year, our teacher, Sister Mary Ignatius, in an effort to prepare us for the rigors of literary criticism, repeatedly assigned what she called deep meaning, or simply DM, and asked us to write. That was a form of X-ray vision, too, not to mention a nod to the power of image itself. Give me 60 words on the DM of a leaf, she'd say out of nowhere. It could be the DM of a blank sheet of paper, or a thumbtack, or a shoe, or a toothpick. She liked it best when a few of us really sucked up and got theological. The thumbtack, for instance, the point which enters the soul, like sin, or the toothpick, a tiny bit of the once mighty tree, just so we can understand God's endless mercy. These she read out loud with pleasure at the end of the hour, while the writer turned color in pride or embarrassment, depending on the level of cynicism involved. My efforts were more along the line of a blank sheet of paper being like snow, a cliche I tried to improve with something like, about these words themselves which make their long way through the frozen cold of the endless blank sheet, one dark footprint at a time, which the wind will dissolve, fill in with more snow and more snow until the world is a blizzard, impossible to see out there, and you keep walking and walking until there's a fence, and then there's an old rusty swing set, and cut. Because I was well over the word limit by then. Sister Ignatius might read mine to the class, but only as an example of what was not truly worthy DM, since this was merely image opening to further image, and it didn't mean very much in the end, this stream of consciousness sort of thing. It was important to focus, and vital to nail it down to a larger issue. No ideas, girls, that's the problem here, she would have said, though I do see an imagination at work. But I'm afraid this writer is just letting herself get carried away. Wasn't that the point? To get carried away? In fact, we loved the whole notion of DM, and at lunch cherished our perverse takes on it, our answer to Sister Sulpice's dating tips, I guess. Those ravioli turned into pillows to tempt boys, or those designing dangerous tablecloths we were supposed to avoid in restaurants because they were white as bedsheets. That's Catholic school for you. Everything means something else. The thing itself constantly projecting a shadow on the wall. This spill, this overlay. Okay, what's the DM of a Kotex? Someone would say, peeling back the wax paper on her cheese sandwich. Durbin, you do that one. Or, what's the DM of an ice cream bar, a retainer, a bicycle seat, a vanilla wafer, our ugly gym uniforms, a jock strap? Eventually, though, the process wore us down. Impossible to live that way. You'd go nuts in a world where nowhere to look without some equation, some meaning dragging behind, no matter how curious or funny or even true. You could never just relax, go oblivious, and let things be. My brother's teenage boy versions, once he got wind of DM, were entirely single-minded. What's a hot dog in a bun? He fired me. What's a plug in a light socket? What's peanut butter and jelly all rolled up in Wonder Bread? He never got off track. It was fairly easy to track Emil's intentions. What was the DM of those girls in his yard? Or his way of stroking my arm, or Francis's, for that matter, his gazing into our eyes. The DM of all that exuberant, read, hopeful talk of the most marvelous female body, which is what he was always telling us. Okay, so one little bit left. I know that I'm supposed to quit soon, but we're still there. At first, I was uncertain whether Francis, via Ned and his fate, was, in fact, Emil immune. After supper, she slipped into the bathroom for quite a while. The faucet in there ran by starts and stops. She was clearly at work washing out a few things, something I needed to do, too, in the hope they'd dry overnight. So it was, for the first time, just Emil and me. What's the DM of the sudden, uncertain drift you sometimes feel, that weight there, moving under the ribcage and down toward your abdomen? Answer, dread and semi-dread. Which is to say, Emil was making advances, another stock expression, this one borrowed from the military arena, battleground talk. His were serious gestures, even I could see that. Not that I was an expert advancee. It usually took something akin to a billboard, no, a nuclear device, to alert me that someone might be interested. My wiring was faulty that way, but it made things simpler, my being stupid about such matters. Not counting the gorgeous Nikostephalopoulos, beau for a night, and in theory only, who took me to the prom as a fix-up, by the way. My first genuine boyfriend, the full-service kind, a friend liked to say, was Jack, the one responsible for my being here at all, having introduced me to Francis. And I was genetically engineered for monogamy, even at the boyfriend level. Still, it didn't seem that citing said boyfriend to Emil as it was a reason for a cease and desist, what was the reason that the cease and desist would count much. I needed another ploy. Emil was giving me a second tour of the place, this time centered on his bedroom. His big bed, which took up nearly the whole space. We stood in the doorway, and he wrapped himself around me. You can sleep here, he said rather sweetly. Emil, I said, yeah, I could, but I can't. It took a while to get that out. without adding the standard, "But you're a nice guy, and I like you a lot" line of crap either. After all, he could have been my father, my grandfather even. He seemed startled by my refusal, but not insulted. "But you must tell me why you can't," he finally said, "so I can convince you." And before I could speak again, he diligently set about himself to that end, murmuring and caressing, "Because I've taken a vow of chastity," I blurted out, trying discreetly to extract myself from his arms. I suppose this was akin to my old Jesuitical move in the confessional at St. Eugene's. "Because I had taken the vow," I told myself. I really had, for that particular spot on earth anyway, the promise going to effect about 3 minutes ago. I could see Emo was still thinking, reconnoitering, that this was a highly original take on the subject. "But you have a boyfriend at home, don't you?" "Poor boyfriend," he nuzzled. "Yes, yes, but I've taken this vow. It's serious. Cross my heart, I mean it." "And will such a vow be in force when you get back?" This was getting tricky. I'd have to stick to my guns, or at least say I would. Luckily, Emil had a new thought. "Ah, but you don't need to do anything," he said suddenly, coming up for air. "You can do nothing to your heart's content and be as chaste as you wish. Just leave it to me. I am strong and hungry. I will do it all." Decades later, it was an old friend who took me to task on the matter. "That sounds too good to be true," she said. "That guy was a total love slave. To let it all happen to you and never have to do a thing? You were out of your mind not to take him up on it. You were crazy." Okay, I'll stop there. So, I don't know if you want to ask questions about this. It was great fun to write this, by the way. And these are all very short chapters, so it's a good bathroom book. Yeah. But, and my intention really was to, you know, I jokingly call it a miwar, which my friend Jane Hamilton calls these things. And she claims she got that name from someone else. But the more I think about it, I think it's more of a wee-war, because I really wanted to show what it was like to, that generation, that period of time is so maligned, or it's so, you know, idealized, one or the other. There's no middle ground. And most of us who went through it, we're in the middle ground. I mean, we were just kind of like young, clueless, inarticulate young people going through it, and it was just wild. The world was just, you know, we did all this stuff. We never told our parents. And so I wanted to get that right. You know, I wanted to, like, get that point of view in there. And it was really fun to go back. And fortunately, I'm married to a pack rat, and I would say, "David, do we have a map of California from 1971? And he'd be like, and then he'd run to the basement, and he'd find such a map and bring it up, and be like, "Oh." So now I can't complain about the basement anymore. But yeah, I mean, it was really fun to write and bring it back, and I actually had to consult things like slang dictionaries to see, you know, to get the speech right, because, you know, nobody said awesome, you know, and to, you know, I remembered a lot of stuff, but it all kind of merges, so I just wanted to be accurate in that. So, it was really, and for a poet, you know, to write these very short chapters is it's a useful method. And then I love bringing in all this crazy Catholic school stuff, which, you know, you really can't put into poems.
How did the book even start? What made you write it in the first place?
Well, this story was such a story. You know, like, halfway there, Francis said to me, "You know, this is not an ordinary trip. I have a mission." I'm like, "What?" We're just going to kick back. And she said, "Yeah, I got to find out what happened to Ned. And we have all these places to stay. Is that okay?" I'm thinking, is that okay? It's like, great. It's like, and I was in the perfect sort of sidekick position to observe it, right? And I realized as I was writing, I realized all sorts of things that I was writing it, that, you know, she was learning more and more about him to sort of, in a way, separate herself from him. But I had seen him around the street. He was like this wild hippie guy with the wild, he was like the classic look. And I didn't know much about him, though. I'd never met him. So I was learning all this stuff, and I was getting more and more involved. So it was really weird. It's like we were going in different directions. And we weren't friends, really. I mean, we were sort of, you know, companions on this trip, which I think was also good in a way. There was some distance. But I got very excited because it just seemed like, suddenly it seemed like some kind of novel, some kind of great story that we were, that this thing would, and it did have that feel all through it because everybody we met had different attitudes toward him, you know. So each of these, you know, I'd write about, like, we first went to people who really, like, an high school classmate, this guy was a lawyer in San Francisco, and he had this very fancy apartment, and we stayed there, and they were very disapproving of Ned, of course. And then we went to Mill Valley, where these guys were all oming and sitting around and passing the joint, and they thought he was a genius, you know, they thought he was like this total mystic, and they were, well, if you read the book, they were on a weird, very weird project of their own that they wanted us to join, and we're like, no. Anyway, and then we went down to Big Sur, and Emil White, you know, we stayed with him, and who, by the way, you can find his paintings. I mean, he's the real guy who, he kind of was a famous, they call them now outsider artist, you know, sort of Grandma Moses type of, he like self-taught, and he did all these paintings, and he showed us some of his paintings. He was pretty neat. I liked him a lot. And he was very kind to us, really. And he finally just gave up on us as, you know, sleeping partners. Thank God. But this is perennial the problem for young women, really, as the young women in this room know. But anyway.
What? By some bizarre chance, a friend of mine house set his house at about the same time, and I've been in it.
Really?
Yeah, yes, I remember there was erotic art in the back. Wasn't there in the tile work or something?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Probably screen that out. Yeah. You know, I was a good Catholic girl, you know. But, like when we showed up, there were two, there's a reference here that, you know, in what I read, but there were two young women nude sunbathing in his yard. And we, you know, we hitchhiked down there, we walked into the, and we're like, oh, my God. You know, of course, I'm like, what? Can't stay here, you know. Ah. And you know, Francis was kind of like, "Eh, don't worry about it. You know, go in there and talk to him." And then they just disappeared. I mean, I looked out the window; they were gone about an hour later. So, so he knew that house.
James Stegan, I went in.
Oh, you did too.
Yes.
Oh well, you have to read this book and tell me if you think it's accurate.
It's a tiny house, wasn't it?
What?
House.
It was very small, but it was, well, yeah, it had like four rooms or something. It was beautiful.
Yeah,
it was
totally
right up the
totally
from the
made, right? I mean,
yeah, handmade. Yeah, 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 yeah.
And it's a museum now, right?
And it's a museum, yeah, for Henry Miller. Yeah, that's why I say. Well, no, he stayed there before that. He said, "You stayed there before that."
I think it was about the same time you were there. I'm not sure.
About 71.
Been,
so you were hanging around, you were wandering around then?
Yes, I was hitchhiking up and down the coast.
See, I'm telling you, this happened. This is nothing original about this. This is why it's a wee-war. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how easy it was to do that. You know, you'd go to a ramp, you know, like on 80. There'd be like 30 people lined up to hitchhike.
I once waited 2 days at one of those ramps.
Yeah,
in California.
Yeah, and the etiquette was you went to the end, and then people were picked off before you. You never just cut in, you know. So, yeah.
I just want to ask, when you went back to school after this trip, like, did it feel strange to be back to school?
Or? No, and oddly, I didn't miss any class. You know.
Was it a hard transition?
No, I mean, it seemed like a dream, you know. It seemed like I had just had this weird dream. But it was so full because it wasn't just wandering around and seeing these cool things. We really, it was great to have that mission, you know. It took me places I would have never gone by myself, right? So, I went there with $20 or something in my pocket and came back with $20. I mean, you know, people fed you, they put you, you know, remember this, right? I mean, it was just, it was wild. I don't know. It's another whole nother time. Yeah.
I know that you write both creative nonfiction, a memoir, and poetry.
Well, and this is my only shot at it.
This is your only shot.
It probably will be my only. Yeah.
But you know, it seems to me that there's a lot of connection between poetry and creative nonfiction.
I agree.
For me, at least, more so than with fiction.
Yeah, I'm always saying this too. I think, yeah, and why do you think that's true? I have all kinds of theories on this. But
well, I'd like to hear your theories. Well, you know, how do you decide what, I mean, now you've had this one book, and so in the future, how do you decide, you know, what genre you're going to write it in or what form it's going to take?
Well, you know, I don't really think of myself as a creative nonfiction writer. I mean, this is kind of a fluke for me, you know? And, you know, the fact is, you know, creative nonfiction, I think I had a hard time getting this an editor to take this because it's not a misery miwar, you know? It's not all about something terrible happening and you survive and you're a better person for it and all that. You know, I'm not a better person because of this. I just, you know, it's just something interesting that happened to me, and I think it really does reflect the time that I wanted to write about it. So, although I think maybe creative nonfiction is opening up beyond that misery miwar thing. But, so I don't really think I'll write most. So it's not like I sit there and think, should this be... Although I do use anecdotal bits in my essays, but mainly I'm writing about poetry. But I will, you know, throw stuff in that I think sort of illustrates some point about the poems or the subject I'm bringing to the, you know, bringing out about the poem. So in that sense, I've always done that. But this is the first time I ever did, like, a narrative.
Yeah, this seems actually more like the genre of fiction than poetry to me. I mean, it's a narrative with interpolated memory.
Oh, yeah, that was great. You know, change over time, and there were characters, and I could refer back, and all that stuff. That was a great pleasure, because you don't really do that in poetry, right? So, yeah, I mean... You know, this is a wonderful experience writing this for me, because, and also just think of how memory works, you know. And there's a lot of sections in here that talk about memory, or refer to it, and, you know, possibly I'd put those in to get myself off the hook, you know. But I think, but of course you're using fictional techniques when you're writing nonfiction, right? It's not like you had a little movie camera then, everything was recorded, so you're inventing. But I think at base, there's nothing invented. All these things happen. All these people were real, and so on. I changed their names, except for Emil White. You know, so. But yeah, I mean, but the connections, I think, getting back to your original thing, I think are, you know, both poetry and the essay or memoir, or whatever. In a way, you can play with time, right? You're not in a finite situation, you're not under the constrictions of normal human time passing, right? The way fiction is. And students in my workshop here, I've already bent your ear on this one, but Russell Edson is a wonderful prose poet. His work, we just lost him. He died in May, but he's talked in an essay about the reason he likes the prose poem is because it's a total mess. You know, you don't know if it's a poem or it's a little piece of prose. And he talks about those two impulses in it. The toward narrative to fiction is, the prose is that it's finite, it's tragic, it will be used up. You know, it has a shape, it goes to an ending point. So once you read a story and you read it again, you're never going to have the same kind of experience because you know what happened, because it's all about moving through human time. So it is finite in a way, but poetry is outside of time, which is why you can keep reading poems over and over again, and they just deepen, really, because they exist outside of time. It's a more meditative form, and I think those things are true of the essay, or, you know, the creative essay or memoir, whatever, because it really is, you're outside of time. You can jump all over the place. You can... It's more of a meditation, you know. You have a sense of the speaker being... Of course, we always talk about the speaker as if, you know, it's not really the poet, but at heart, people think it's the poet. I mean, really. So there's that kind of thing about the speaker in an essay, too. Personal essay, right? But yeah, I think they're really close. But one of the reasons I wanted to write this, I could put all that crazy Catholic school stuff in here, which I really can't much do in poems. Although last night I read one about a sixth grade classroom. So what do you think are the differences or the similarities?
Well,
It's a fascinating thing for me because I don't know totally what I think. It changes all the time, and I can see connections, you know, among those three genres.
Yeah.
But it just, I guess as for myself, I had more trouble with plot, which again would be that sequencing of the action through time.
But if it's handed to you, like this, this happened to me, so I know the story, right?
Right.
So I was just retelling that, but you still want that immediate experience of like, oh my God, I'm retelling this, and what do I think about it now, right? So that's part of that memoir thing, the added level, yeah. Yeah, I think with fiction you have to make it all up. That would be really hard to be credible, I think, you know? Yeah, I think that's exactly what you're saying, exactly the problem and the difference, yeah. Yeah.
Do you know anything about what happened to Woody or Francis after the trip? Or like?
The only thing I know is, I mean, I liked Woody a lot. I never, he sort of disappeared. And pretty much Francis did too. Let's see. I got back to Champaign. That's where I was a student. Champaign, as we call it. I never saw Woody or Francis again. Jack, that was my boyfriend, I hung on for a little longer, off and on. The last I heard from Francis came in a letter. I was standing in the yard of the place I had rented with some friends the following fall. 209, we still call it, since that's where it was on Clark's before they bulldozed it. The mailman showed up with a note from Francis, forwarded from Delacroix's boarding house on Green Street, where I had lived earlier. I turned the envelope over, in disbelief, I need to say. Mr. Postman, she had scrawled in red pencil, Jesus loves you. But such a moment, this too was of the time and of that place. I've met someone, she wrote in a letter. He was sweet, he was a Jesus freak. Francis lived with a bunch of them now in a large apartment above a bowling alley. Standing there, I read again what she had written. For the first time, she was really happy. She would pray for me. So that was the last I heard from Francis. So she had totally, that trip had, you know, put everything aside. So, and settled things for her. So what happened after that, I don't know. And she no doubt married and changed her name, so I don't know how even to trace that. Yeah, yeah. But people would make these sudden transitions in that period, too. So that was really part of the time and place. I was just trying to get the time and place, but this actually happened. I remember when I saw that scroll on there, I thought, whoa, okay. You know, this was wild Francis, you know, who did all this stuff. I mean, so, anyway. Yeah.
I love this book very much. I read it this summer. I really enjoyed it. So many... One thing, you mentioned that the $10 bill that was in your pocket at the end, just like the notion of like being led throughout, like, I don't think you paid for a meal or anything, just like you had like a mission you were following along. I just like find that very compelling. I just wonder, like, have you ever thought that, like, what was, can you speak about the experience in Mill Valley a little bit? And also at the first place you stayed in San Francisco with like the shrine, the photo shrine of Ned, you didn't mention that at all. Just like that discovery of like what that image meant and like what it actually was and its genesis. Felt like a really compelling part, integral part of the story.
Okay, well, if I can time, yeah. Those are two big visits, right?
Yeah.
I referred to earlier the apartment of the sort of upscale friend, right, in San Francisco, and when we what Barrett is referring to is we were given a little guest room with a little bathroom, which was like seemed really exotic, you know, to have your own bathroom, and so. You know, I went into the bathroom, and then there was this, you know, people would do this a lot, actually, in those, you remember this. People would cut out pictures, like from Life magazine or whatever, and they put them on their wall in these collages, you know. And so somebody had done that in the bathroom, and there were all these, like, famous people, you know, Gandhi and, you know, Robert Kennedy and, you know, Martin Luther King, and, but like, all these people in a kind of orbit, kind of circuit, and right in the middle was this enlarged picture of Ned, you know, like with his wild hair, and he's like looking out, I was like totally freaked out to see this, you know. So that was kind of like a shrine to Ned in this apartment of otherwise very kind of upscale, perfectly appointed people, right? So that was pretty interesting that was there, and it kind of complicated the people somehow. And Karen and I talked a lot about that, yeah. So there were things like that all along that were like just totally. You can see how I thought, my God, I'm living a short story or something. This is so amazing. So, and I had this thing intact in my head for a long time. I kept telling the story to everyone. I was hoping my son would write it, but he had no interest, of course. It's not his story, right? So, Mom, you told me the story like 400 times. I said, okay. So I thought, well, hell with it. I finally did it. Yeah. The Mill Valley thing I'm talking about, we went from San Francisco there up to Mill Valley where, as I said earlier, Ned had stayed with these guys who were kind of living in a sort of commune, and they were always oming and smoking dope and building their boat. They had a guru that, you know, it was like guru culture. They had a guru and all this. So we got kind of drawn into that for briefly. But again, it's so of the time, right? But we had a very sort of jaundiced view of a lot of it, and at the same time we were sucked in, which is basically what the kind of ironic vision that people had, even as it was happening, you know. It was pretty exciting, too. So, anybody else? Thoughts? Thanks for coming, guys. That is a weird hour.